Well, this is pretty exciting, and if privilege could be quantified, I would say this is an immense amount of privilege that I have addressing you, all the people, whoever they are, or however many, who are listening to these daily videos that I make. We've got a daily scripture, that's right, and we have, it's going to be Ecclesiastes 10 and 4, but our crucible article, C cubed or C3, the crucible of credible creed, paragraphs 5, 6, chapter 5, paragraphs 6 and 7, for today, because they're very short. And how does the genealogy explain Jericho and Hazor, which we've been discussing, in terms of the dating and the events of the burning, for example, that occurred? The burning was also true of Jericho, I believe, wasn't it? Yeah. But Hazor was burned, and there was a burning layer that was found in the archaeological layer of the city, as well as, according to the Bible. And as for those two cities, how does the genealogy confirm the reign of Pharaoh Hatshepsut, who is the Pharaoh concerning which this chapter is written? And she ruled until 1469 BCE. Does the chronology that we are studying, the genealogy, explain those two cities in the context of the end of the reign of Pharaoh Hatshepsut in BCE 1469? That's a mouthful. After the death of Hatshepsut in 1469 BCE, paragraph 5-7, seeing 17 years remain at that point to the fall of Jericho in BCE 1452, which is our date, the genealogy, and no one else seems to use the 1452 date except for us, which is not always a bad thing, because we know we don't want to be a part of some other organization. So may the scarab found in the grave at Jericho be a completely normal expression of the events that occurred within the crucible. In other words, our chronology, is it normal? That's why we call it the crucible. We're testing the events. Do the events make sense? The fact that the scarab is there shows that there were certain events, because the scarab ended up in the grave at Jericho. Do the events make sense in our chronology? We're not going to really answer these questions. These are just food for thought, but we have answered them already in a very minor way, but, you know, because we know that there's a gap between the scarab of Thutmose III and the three reigns later scarab found in Jericho also. All of these were found at Jericho. The scarab of Amenhotep the third, yeah, because Amenhotep the fourth was Akhenaten. His father was Amenhotep the third, and there was a gap of two pharaohs in between Thutmose III and Amenhotep the third, which is perfect in our chronology. It's a very small piece of evidence, but we have so much other evidence, and then that little tiny piece of evidence also showed that after Israel conquered Jericho, there was a gap when there were no scarabs put in the graves at Jericho, at least according to the evidence. And then when Eglon ruled, right in his time period when he was reigning from Jericho as an oppressor in Israel, another scarab appeared in a grave in Jericho. In the chronology of the Pharaoh of Egypt, Amenhotep III, which also fit perfectly well with the chronology of Eglon, the oppressive king during the period of Judges in Israel. So it's just a remarkable thing. How is our date 1452 for the fall of Jericho? Right, it looks great when we ask this question. Right now, it looks so great. And the scarab of Hatshepsut could have been found because she reigned before the fall of Jericho. So there were no Israelites there to prevent the collection of scarabs by the residents of the city. See, the Israelites wouldn't have been collecting scarabs of the Egyptian pharaohs. They wouldn't have been interested in that because they had their own God, Jehovah, and they just didn't have that kind of type of... It's sort of a worship. Collecting things is kind of like a form of worship, like collecting coins is sort of worship in a way. But the Israelites, whether they would do... Well, back in those days, they certainly wouldn't. Maybe they're certainly probably... possibly Jewish people who collect coins these days, but they're not perhaps devout worshippers of Jehovah who collect coins because or collect anything like stamps or coins or whatever you collect. I mean, it's just it goes counter to the idea of true worship of Jehovah. You don't collect little items, and you're not superstitious, and then have these little items that you hold on to out of superstition. So it's not at all out of harmony with what we believe about our chronology to see these scarabs occurring at the times they do. It's phenomenal. Now, Ecclesiastes 10 and 7, little children, says, if the spirit of a ruler should mount up against you, do not leave your own place, for calmness itself allays great sins. It's remarkable that, I mean, basically, we... as worshippers of Jehovah, we basically have no trouble obeying all the laws. We obey the kings and all the laws. We obey them just naturally because we believe in subjecting ourselves to the superior authorities, as Romans 13:1 says, and as Jesus also did when he paid taxes. So, I mean, it's true that we have no trouble with obeying the law. It just is something we do implicitly and explicitly too. But of course, there are some governments that whose laws, the laws of which, do not comply with Jehovah's standards. They're unrighteous in an extreme way, or some violation of, you know, what would be love. And they would be, you know, they're not put in place for the benefit of people, but these are oppressive laws preventing the operation of the Holy Spirit or, the truth and love and all that. If those laws have to be disobeyed, and they are by Jehovah's people. So, but generally, like, we certainly pay our taxes and we obey all the laws as a general matter of course, because we don't... we know that they're put in place by people who are lawmakers for our own good. But if the spirit of a ruler should mount up against us, it doesn't mean we just change what we're doing either. It says, do not leave your own place, for calmness itself allays great sins, little ones. That's something to think about very, very, very intently. Okay, 2 Kings 5. Now, a certain Naaman, the chief of the army of the king of Syria, during the time of Elisha, as we are going to see, had become a great man before his Lord and held in esteem, because it was by him that Jehovah had given salvation to Syria. And the man himself had proved to be a valiant, mighty man, though a leper. And the Syrians, for their part, had gone out as marauder bands, and they got to take captive from the land of Israel a little girl. And she came to be before Naaman's wife. In time she said to her mistress, if only my lord were before the prophet that is in Samaria. She called her captor her lord. She was respectful of the people who had captured her. In that case, he would recover him from his leprosy, if he were before the prophet that is in Samaria. Subsequently, when the little girl told them this, someone came and reported to his lord, saying, it was like this and that that the little girl spoke, who is from the land of Israel. Then the king of Syria said, get going. Come and let me send a letter to the king of Israel. And so he proceeded to go and take in his hand 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of garments. And he came bringing the letter to the king of Israel, saying, And now at the same time that this letter comes to you, here I do send to you Naaman, my servant, that you may recover him from his leprosy. And it came about that as soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he immediately ripped his garments apart and said, Am I God to put to death and to preserve alive? Am I God? For this person is sending to me to recover a man from his leprosy. For just take note, please you men, and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me. He's looking for a fight. That's what the king said, the king of Israel. And it came about as soon as Elisha, the man of the true God, heard that the king of Israel had ripped his garments apart, he at once sent to the king, saying, Why did you rip your garments apart? Let him come, please, to me, that he may know that there exists a prophet in Israel. So Naaman came with his horses and his war chariots and stood at the entrance of the house of Elisha. However, Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, Going there, you must bathe 7 times in the Jordan, that your flesh may come back to you and be clean, the Jordan River. At this, Naaman grew indignant and began to go away and say, Here I had said to myself, To me he will come out all the way, and he will certainly stand and call upon the name of Jehovah his God and move his hand to and fro over the place and actually give the leper recovery. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Can I not bathe in them and certainly be clean? With that he turned and went away in a rage. His servants now approached and spoke to him and said, My father, had it been a great thing that the prophet himself had spoken to you, would you not do it? How much more then, since he said to you, Bathe and be clean? At that he went down and began to plunge into the Jordan 7 times according to the word of the man of the true God, after which his flesh came back like the flesh of a little boy, and he became clean. Then he went back to the man of the true God, he with all his camp, and came and stood before him and said, Here now, I certainly know that there is no God anywhere in the earth but in Israel. And now accept, please, a blessing gift from your servant. However, he said, As Jehovah before whom I do stand is living, I will not accept it. And he began to urge him to accept it, but he kept refusing. Finally, Naaman said, If not, please, let there be given to your servant some ground, the load of a pair of mules, because your servant will no more render up a burnt offering or a sacrifice to any other gods but to Jehovah. This is interesting. Naaman said, If you're not going to take my gift, then let there be given to your servant some ground. The load of a pair of mules. He wanted to carry some of the ground on the backs of the mules. In this thing, may Jehovah forgive your servant when my Lord comes into the house of Rimmon. To bow down there, he is supporting himself upon my hand. When he goes back to Syria, that is. And I have to bow down at the house of Rimmon. When I bow down at the house of Rimmon, may Jehovah please forgive your servant in this respect. At this he said to him, Go in peace. Accordingly, he went away from him for a good stretch of the land. And Gehazi, the attendant of Elisha, the man of the true God, said, Here my master has spared Naaman the Syrian by not accepting from his hand what he brought. As Jehovah is living, I will run after him and take something from him. And Gehazi went chasing after Naaman. When Naaman saw someone running after him, he at once got down from his chariot to meet him and then said, Is all well? To this he said, All is well. My master himself has sent me, saying, Look, just now there have come to me two young men from the mountainous region of Ephraim, from the sons of the prophets. Do give them, please, a talent of silver and two changes of garments. At that, Naaman said, go on, take two talents. Take two talents. And he kept urging him and finally bound up two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and gave them to two of his attendants that they might carry them before him. When he came to Ophel, wow, he immediately took them from their hand and deposited them in the house and sent the men away. So off they went, and he himself came in and then stood by his master. Elisha now said to him, where did you come from, Gehazi? But he said, your servant did not go anywhere at all. At that he said to him, did not my heart itself go along just as the man turned to get down off his chariot to meet you? You know, Elisha knew where he'd gone. He knew he'd gone to take money and, you know, whatever he could take from Naaman. He knew he'd gone to get something since Naaman had offered a payment and Elisha had declined to accept it. Is it a time to accept silver, Elisha said, or to accept garments, or olive groves, or vineyards, or sheep, or cattle, or men servants, or maid servants? So the leprosy of Naaman will stick to you and your offspring to time indefinite. That was what Elisha said. Immediately he went out from before him, did Gehazi, a leper, white as snow. What a punishment. He was not obedient, was he, to what, or loyal to his master Elisha, to what Elisha had said about not taking a gift from Naaman in exchange for a miracle. Similarly, we shouldn't take gifts in exchange for miracles either. We're going to look now at Ezekiel, I believe, chapter 29. This is good. More chronological information. In the 10th year, must be the 10th year of the exile, since chapter 1 began with the 5th year of the exile. The 10th year in the 10th month on the 12th day of the month. And this is before the capture of Jerusalem in the 11th year of the exile. Right? As long as the exile is counted from, you know, the time 597, which we count it from. Of course, yeah, the exile, it's not counted from the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem that led to the exile, if there was a siege at that time. It's counted from the actual exile. And in the 11th year of the exile is where, which was the 11th year of the king Zedekiah also, right? That's where precisely in the 5th month, on the 10th day, Jerusalem was burned, or the temple was burned, which is very close to the time when the city was captured. So, if not the same time. Son of man, set your face again. I mean, it was just a matter of days, or, you know, it wasn't an issue of months. Certainly not years, or not even 1 year, but certainly it was just, well, we don't really have the, it says the temple, we know what day the temple was burned. It doesn't precisely say, you know, chronologically the event when they entered the city, the first, what day that was, and so on. It doesn't give us that information, but we know it's all happening at the same time. Once they conquer the city, there's no more fight and no more delay anymore. So it was the 9th or 10th day, because there's two accounts of it. It's the 9th or 10th day of the 5th month that these things occurred with regard to the burning of the temple. Son of man, so it probably overlapped, you know, between those 2 days. Son of man, set your face against Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against Egypt in its entirety. So this is the year before the conquest of Jerusalem. Ezekiel's being told to prophesy against Egypt. Speak, and you must say, this is what the sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Here I am against you, O Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great sea monster lying stretched out in the midst of his Nile canal. It's an illustration. The Pharaoh as a sea monster. stretched out in the midst of his Nile canals. Nile canals. Well, that's a difficult. Nile canals, because it's got the N and the L, and then the N and the L again. Nile canal. This great sea monster that has said, my Nile River belongs to me, and I have made it for myself. And I will put hooks in your jaws, Jehovah says, and cause the fish of your Nile canals to cling or stick to your scales. And I will bring you up out of the midst of your Nile canals, and all the fish of your Nile canals that cling to your very scales. Jehovah said he would bring the great sea monster, the Pharaoh, up out of the midst of the Nile canals and out of the midst of all the fish of his Nile canals that cling to your very to his very scales. And I will abandon you, he said to the Pharaoh, to the wilderness, you and all the fish of your Nile canals. Upon the surface of the field you will fall. Bringing the sea monster out into the wilderness, you will not be gathered up nor be collected together. To the wild beasts of the earth and to the flying creatures of the heavens I will give you for food. And all the inhabitants of Egypt will have to know that I am Jehovah, for the reason that they prove to be as a support. That's meaning the inhabitants of Egypt supported Israel. A reed they proved to be to the house of Israel. When they took hold of you by the hand, you got to be crushed, meaning Israel took hold of Egypt by the hand. Egypt got to be crushed, and you caused, that is, Egypt caused a split in Israel's entire shoulder. And when they supported themselves upon you, you got to be broken, and you caused all their hips to wobble. In another place in the scripture, a fractured reed, a broken reed, is said to pierce through the palm of the hand when someone attempts to support himself upon it. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Ezekiel 29, verse 8. Here I am, bringing upon you a sword, and I will cut off from you earthling man and domestic animal, saying to Egypt, and the land of Egypt must become a desolate waste and a devastated place. And they will have to know that I am Jehovah, for the reason that he said to me, that is, the Pharaoh said, the Nile River belongs, and I myself have made it. And Jehovah says, therefore, here I am against you and against your Nile canals, and I will make the land of Egypt devastated places, dryness, a desolated waste, from Migdol to Syene and to the boundary of Ethiopia. There will not pass through it the foot of earthling man, nor will the foot of domestic animal pass through it, and for 40 years it will not be inhabited. Now this is significant because there's a study article in the Insight book regarding the section entitled Egypt. It talks about this section in the book of Ezekiel, that is chapter 29, verses 1 through 16, it talks about the desolation of Egypt, foretold to last 40 years. It said this may have come after Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Egypt. While some commentaries, it goes on, refer to the reign of Amasis, or Amos II, the successor of Hophra, or Apres, as he's called, also, as exceedingly prosperous, the reign of Amasis, some commentaries say, during more than 40 years. They do so primarily. It's interesting, his reign was about 40 years, Amasis. So this is remarkable because of this period of 40 years that was talked about, and it was predicted, prophesied in the Bible. It was prophesied here, right here, Ezekiel 29:11. 40 years, there would not be inhabitants in Egypt. So what does it mean? Because some commentators say it was a very prosperous reign, those 40 years. But primarily that's based on the testimony of Herodotus, as pointed out by the Insight books. And Herodotus got all his information from the Egyptian priests. And the Egyptian priests were not the most reliable source of information, seeing as they did not wish to embarrass the Egyptian government. So they wouldn't tell stories that would cast the government in a bad light or make, you know, a period of 40 years appear to have been unprosperous. So it's questionable whether the information that was gained by Herodotus was entirely accurate. That's the point here. So we don't have to accept the information that's given by Herodotus, even though he is the father of history as we know it. That's what he's called. But it says the whole history or story by Herodotus of Apries, who's also called Hophra, and Amasis, who's Amos, this whole story is mixed with so much that is inconsistent and legendary that we may very well hesitate to adopt it as authentic history. So that's interesting that we can see that it's not entirely without question, this story about Egypt as it's given in history. We should always question history, but the prophecy of the Bible here gives us pause, in this case, even more so to question it, because it goes on, verse 12, "And I will make the land of Egypt a desolate waste in the midst of desolated lands, and its own cities will become a desolate waste in the very midst of devastated cities for 40 years. There it is again. 40 years, and I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations and disperse them among the lands. For this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. At the end of 40 years I shall collect the Egyptians together out of the peoples among whom they will have been scattered, and I will bring back the captive group of the Egyptians, and I will bring them back to the land of Pathros, to the land of their origin, and there they must become a lowly kingdom, lower than the other kingdoms it will become. And it will no more lift itself up over the other nations, and I will make them so few." We know Egypt was a world power at one time, and then Assyria became the major world power after Egypt. And then Babylon became the world power after that. And during the time of Ezekiel, it was the time when Babylon was, by that time, the world power. So Egypt was not a great power, even at this time, but lower than the other kingdoms it will become, and it will no more lift itself up over the other nations, and I will make them so few so as not to have the other nations in subjection. So there's the prophecy. Fascinating, but of course, it was well on the way to already being the case. So Egypt was already in struggle against Nebuchadnezzar and against, there were already conflicts. Necho had battled with Josiah, and he was an Israelite, but there had been the great battle at Carchemish between Nebuchadnezzar and the Egyptians. So they were already in struggle, and it will no more prove to be the house of Israel's confidence. But the Babylonians were already in power at the time of Ezekiel. Assyria's time had even passed. So Egypt was no longer in the picture anyway. This is really almost a prophecy after the fact. But the important thing here is it will no more prove to be the house of Israel's confidence, bringing error to remembrance by their turning after them. So Israel would not, as prophesied here, rely on Egypt anymore. And they will have to know that I am the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. Now it came about in the 27th year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, that the word of Jehovah occurred to me. So 27 years of the 27th year of the exile, right? And the defeat of the fall of Jerusalem happened in the 11th year of the exile. So 27 minus 11 is 16. There was a 13-year exile. The siege of Tyre. And this is talking about the siege of Tyre. So the 27th minus the 11th is 16 years. And the 13-year siege is what I'm talking about. 16 minus 13 is 3. And so the siege of Jerusalem actually occurred about 1 or 2 years prior. So it becomes 4 or 5 years between the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem and the beginning of the siege of Tyre, when we do the math. You can do the math, little children. It's with the help of someone if you need help. But there you get. So what Clark said about approximately a 5-year difference between the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem and that of Tyre is correct. Son of Man, you know, this 27th year, first month, first day of the month, word of Jehovah occurred to Ezekiel saying, Son of Man, Nebuchadrezzar himself, the king of Babylon, made his military force perform a great service against Tyre. Every head was one made bald. We mentioned this scripture earlier. And every shoulder was one rubbed bare. But as for wages, there proved to be none for him and his military force from Tyre for the service that he had performed against her. He wasn't able to get his wages because they'd carried all the valuables of Tyre onto the island part of the city. And Nebuchadnezzar was a land force. He couldn't cross the open water, which Alexander the Great did cross by building a causeway, pitching the city and the rubble of the city into the sea to build that causeway in BCE 332, which everybody agrees as to its date concerning Alexander's conquest of Tyre. But in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, he wasn't able to get any wages from his conquest of Tyre. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. Here I am giving to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the land of Egypt, and he must carry off its wealth and make a big spoil of it and do a great deal of plundering of it, and it must become wages for his military force as his compensation for service that he did against her. I have given him the land of Egypt because they acted for me, is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. Nebuchadnezzar acted on behalf of Jehovah when he conquered both Jerusalem and when he conquered Tyre, because Tyre was scoffing at the conquest of Jerusalem, making a mockery of the Israelites, and Jehovah punished them for that. In that day, and he punished the Israelites for being unfaithful too. In that day, verse 21, I shall cause a horn to sprout for the house of Israel and to you. I shall give occasion to open the mouth in the midst of them. And they will have to know that I am Jehovah. To you, to Israel, I shall give occasion to open the mouth in the midst of them. And they will have to know that I am Jehovah. Talking about the Messiah, the sprout, which is also mentioned, as we see in our article, Born and Raised. The sprout was prophesied by both Isaiah and by Jeremiah. And here it is also prophesied by Ezekiel in chapter 29, verse 21. The horn to sprout. The sprout was prophesied by all three prophets, fascinatingly, about the Messiah. So that's a prophecy about the Messiah right there, messianic in its nature, which is unbelievably exciting. It's faithfully exciting. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John writes in Revelation chapter 21. But we're out of time. I talk so long without realizing it about Ezekiel. We'll have to do this another day. On my behalf, right, today it's January 21st, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 21:27 hours Eastern Standard Time. And on my behalf, this is Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.